Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ron and Don Show. My name is Don Allen. Over in Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, real good, Mr. Allen. And, happy to be back in Minnesota. And I want to, once again, before we go to tonight's program, thank you and others for your condolences and on the passing of my mother. But back here, and it looks like we've got quite a program tonight. I'm not sure that the NSA is not even listening in. What do we got, Don? I'm hearing all kinds of things since I came back in town yesterday afternoon.
Well, Mr. Harris, we have some wild things happening in the community, and I need to justify, you know, this program and the reason, you know, we're staying in our lane. We are news people, and we report the news, and we're not necessarily helping you point the finger, but the fingers are pointing pretty directly at a few folks. And with that said, Mr. Edwards, two things. Well, let's just start with the main thing. I was shocked when some professionals in local white radio drove my attention to a YouTube video of Jamar Clark's sister saying that she's basically been ripped off. Jamar was buried without a headstone, and she alleges that people are driving around with new BMWs and money in the bank. She names some organizations in this particular YouTube video. And I know our listeners, Mr. Edwards, are probably just saying, wow, it's on YouTube. We can't hear it. But at the Ron and Don Show, we have the capability of downloading that into a file that you can listen to.
Absolutely.
Yes. So, Mr. Edwards, without further ado, I think we should get this out of the way because the phone lines are lighting up. And
okay.
I think we should go ahead and just play this and let people listen to Jamar Clark's sister alleging that she's been ripped off for about $100,000.
On my way home? Like, really?
Okay.
Everybody was fuck with my brother like that. So they don't want to even let they don't want to let me speak. That's why I didn't speak. Like on the real shit.
That
shit crazy. Cause it was said that his mom's son, which is I mean, that's my stepbrother. We grew up together.
Uh-huh.
It was saying he collected like $27,000. Now he's denying it. But I know it's like almost $11,000 in the account that he still has over, which you just confronted about. Like, why are you collecting $11,000? And then he want to put it off on Kenya McKnight, which is my sister and brother's first cousin on their mom's.
Hold on, hold on. I know her from Minneapolis,
yeah,
right?
But Yanni, okay, that's Yanni. But
she's a Muslim.
You know,
she's a Muslim, right?
Yeah, before the funeral, she got a BMW truck. We seen that. And then 7 days after we came home, she got it like a 2016. But she was in charge of some of the shit, too. Like, where did you get this money from all of a sudden? Like,
well,
for real.
I will say this. She's been getting big grant money around here for the public schools and for nonprofits. I can speak on her. She's been getting money doing nonprofit
right,
things.
But understand, she's in the family. There
right.
was something going on between her and my brother's brother, Jamar's brother, Blue Man, which is Eddie, and they fell out before the funeral about money. And she accused him of getting $27,000. And I was on the phone with my dad, which is Jamar's dad,
uh-huh.
when she came and told him that I'm going to set up an account for you and Irma, which is Jamar's mom, natural mom, and nobody ever heard nothing from those accounts. So,
what
I tell you.
Uh-huh.
It's some funny shit going on with money. It is.
So what do you need from me? What do you need me to do for you?
I need to know what the organizations was that collected this money and how much was it, because they're pointing fingers at each other of who got what.
Now, I'm not with an organization, so I'm by myself. I came up there because I'm a part of the neighborhood.
But I'm telling you the names that they just gave on the phone. My brother don't have a headphone. And from what I'm hearing from both sides, from Kenya and Eddie, is that tens of thousands of dollars was collected, so why don't my brother have a headphone?
Hold on, I'm writing this down. What other organizations you said? Black Lives Matter?
The Urban League.
Urban League.
Black Lives Matter.
Uh-huh.
NAACP. And whatever is on Penn and Plymouth. Some lady named Jamie.
That's the Urban League. That's the Urban League on Penn and Plymouth.
Okay, so some lady named Jamie is supposed to have opened an account.
I'll check into this. Jamie and Kenya.
On Penn and Plymouth.
And how much funds have been misappropriated?
Well, from what I heard previously, it was like $100,000 altogether.
Oh, my God.
I mean, literally, I'm like, what the fuck is going on? It's like every man for himself.
That's ugly. You don't do that.
The casket was donated. I don't know what if his funeral was paid for, donated. I just need your help and to figure out what's going on, because we're not even supposed to be going through this.
No, you're not.
Then he has like an adoptive family that he stayed with for a number of years. Now, they're trying to cash out, even though he ain't been around them in years. He changed his name back to my dad's last name, and he was with my dad's Saturday family, which I deal.
Let me ask you a question. Is that dude Prince Hollywood? Now, check this out. This is what kills me, right? There was a dude.
Prince Hollywood, I've been talking to him because he said he was his friend.
Okay, now listen to this. Now check this out, right?
Okay.
Your brother's name is Clark, okay? Prince Hollywood.
No, it's supposed to be Clark, but they see in the deal because he tried to get a job under Clark, but he couldn't.
Okay.
They said legally his last name was Hill.
Okay, well check it out. Prince Hollywood told me that was his cousin, and that's why they had the same last names, and he was running the protest down there. Talking about his cousin. Now, when he told...
Wait, so Prince Hollywood is the Clark? I thought it was just Cameron.
No, he's a Clark.
Okay, Mr. Edwards, I am going to actually stop there because we get into that back and forth with people that are private citizens, basically, and we don't want to get them mixed up in all this craziness. But that's the tape.
Let's do this, Don, for absolute transparency, mm-hmm. if you will. But we have great latitude on Blog Radio with regards to what it is that we can put on the air. The person that was interviewing the sister, you did not identify that person. Who is he? What is his name?
He doesn't have. Let me go back to that particular.
He has a name. I know who he is. He goes by a specific name, but he is really a hugger. So let's make sure we get that out there. He is Bobby Hugger, who I've known for many years, is his father. But we owe it
he
to our
himself.
Listening audience across the United States and in the foreign territories, if you will, because he was not initially identified by you in playing this particular recording. By the way, this was a telephone conversation in which the sister was informed by the gentleman in question that he was going to record it. She said she had no problem with it in the original interception of this series of telephone calls. Now, my understanding is that a white blog network, quote-unquote, was able to retrieve this. Could you just kind of explain that to us for those of our listeners that are not as sophisticated?
Actually, the person who recorded it, he goes by the Honorable Gaetano Lucci, is his name.
That's right.
And it came off a blog site. I think it actually ran by him, Mr. Edwards, but I was alerted to it by some white gentlemen in mainstream media who uh-huh. says, "Have you seen this yet?" And early this morning, and I was like, "Wow, I haven't seen it." So it was shocking to hear this video and listen to what's going on because, you know, I'm not really a legal expert, but Mr. Edwards, to me, this kind of sounds like a legal matter. At this point, or investigative.
Well, it certainly is because on this particular call, it has already been vetted, if you will. The sister made a couple of disturbing statements and reflections. Number one, she indicated her brother does not even have a headstone. Number two, there was some concern that even the casket had been rented. I do know from conversations with individuals inside of Shiloh International Ministries and the very respected Bishop Howe, that Bishop Howe saw himself confronted by the family because there had been a misrepresentation about the change of program on the day of the funeral. And statements were made, and I understand there was a $6,000 exchange that could not be explained. Bishop Howe was not aware of it. Those who were facilitating the arrangements for the funeral definitely were aware of it. And that made sense. It was only after Bishop Howe in a meeting. We want to be clear with this over the air. It was only after a meeting with President Brooks of the National NAACP at St. Peter's AME Church in South Minneapolis, 41st and 4th. That's your part of town there, Mr. Allen. It was at mm-hmm. that particular meeting that Bishop Howe, in the presence of elected political leaders and appointed and other ministers, talked in terms of a very questionable operation in which he felt that there had been mismanagement of significant monies in the preparation of the funeral for the deceased. Now it all begins to make sense. Now,
yes,
I know
yes,
earlier this afternoon, our enterprise, our operation, based on another piece of information you're getting ready to share with our listening audience, asked the Office of the National NAACP in Baltimore, Maryland, to respond to some of the statements that Mr. Allen is going to be reading to us. That is an exchange, one-sided though, of text messages between the first vice president and the president of the NAACP. Is that correct?
That is correct. I am actually pulling that up now as we speak, Mr. Edwards. This is some deep, interesting, very interesting stuff.
Now, this comes at a time when there are rumors abounding that the NAACP of Minneapolis is under examination by the national NAACP in Baltimore, Maryland, particularly after the visit here by President Brooks, in which he was confronted, really, by elected and appointed African-American leaders. Again, so that folks are clear, this was a meeting at St. Peter's AME Church in South Minneapolis, one of the most prestigious black churches in the African-American community, where about, I don't know, 22 or 23 of the most powerful black ministers in the city sat down with President Brooks and had just a wealth, quote-unquote, of information about serious problems with the NAACP. Now, after President Brooks returned to Baltimore, he directed his director of branches, the Reverend Gail Ford, who is well known in this area and around the NAACP family, to begin an immediate inquiry relevant to allegations that had been made at that meeting at St. Peter's and additional meetings. Now, it is my understanding, based on last week's program, that Mr. Nelson, who is a member of the NAACP and was threatened at a NAACP branch meeting on the first Tuesday of this month, that Mr. Nelson has filed a formal complaint with the State Conference of the NAACP, which has been forwarded to the National for an investigation. And the word that is now coming out of the East is that the National Office is about to appoint a special investigator, probably a national board member, probably an attorney, probably maybe even a former judge or a current judge, to conduct an examination and to hold a possible meeting and hearing. Now, what Mr. Allen, I assume you've called it up, Don, what Mr. Allen is getting ready to... Huh?
I'm there. I'm ready.
All right. What Mr. Allen is getting ready to read to our listening audience is an exchange, one-sided as it may be, between, as I understand it, so we're absolutely clear, the first vice president of the Minneapolis branch of the NAACP to the president of the Minneapolis branch of the NAACP, Nakimi Alave Pounds. Am I correct, sir?
You are correct and more. So, yeah.
All right. Please enlighten us with regards to what continues to be a serious political and internal fallout.
On December 8th at 11:26 a.m., an email sent out by Minneapolis NAACP communications person Rashida Williams. Hello, everyone. The Communications Committee is working with the Criminal Justice Reform Committee to host a press conference today at the 4th Precinct at 2 p.m. We are asking the City of Minneapolis to remove the barricades and fencing around the precinct. Below is the press release that was sent out. Community residents and victims shot during the occupation will speak during the conference along with Jason Soul and Nakima. Sincerely, Rashida Williams. Okay, now, in answer to that, there was an email sent by the first vice president, Ms. Tanya Johnson, to Ms. Rashida Williams. Also copied were NAACP members and public persons, Angela Williams, Helen Bassett, Bertha Daniels, Bill Cotman, Kathy Burton, Georgia Hadego, James Everett, Jason Soule, Carrie Jo Felder, Lissa Jones, Nakima Levy Pounds, Oliver, Rashida Williams, Sherlyn LaChapelle, Wintana, excuse me, Melkin, and Kalis Houston. The first vice president writes, Mr. Edwards, here's what she writes. She says, I'm not clear. Any action taken by Nakima has to go through the executive committee for approval, according to the bylaws. You stated that the press release went out without approval, so why are you sending this to us? As an FYI, sorry, I don't approve, sent from her iPhone. And that was sent from her iPhone at December, same day, December 8th, about an hour later. Mr. Edwards, as a member in good standing of the Minneapolis NAACP, I took it upon myself to forward both emails to Reverend Gil Ford, and I did copy W.C. Jordan, who's the Minnesota State Chair and the President of the Minneapolis NAACP, Nakima Levy-Pounds. And my email was, Dear Reverend Ford, it seems the Minneapolis NAACP has grown its own bylaws and procedures. As a member in good standing, can you rule on these events that do not have executive committee approval? Best, Don Allen. So that was a series of emails, Mr. Edwards, that I shot out and that I received surreptitiously on the Internet from some very concerned NAACP members and outliers.
Wow. So... And of course, always, our phone lines are open. We know there are many supporters on both sides of the aisle. Later on in this program, we will talk in terms of a resolution that is being developed as we speak by the black associations of both the Minneapolis Police Department and the Minneapolis Fire Department, based on the outrageous conduct, if you will, by the NAACP and to a lesser degree, of course, Black Lives Matter, only a lesser degree because Black Lives Matter really doesn't have a formal structure per se. The NAACP does, and there is now an issue within the NAACP which was expressed in the meeting at St. Peter's AME Church that the Minneapolis branch of the NAACP has not acquired the necessary insurance and bonding in light of the 18-day occupation of the 4th Precinct in North Minneapolis. And so we are really, as journalists, trying to get a feeling on what the heck has happened here. And now we have allegations, which my associate, Mr. Allen, played, what was a quote-unquote audio/video that talks in terms of as much as $100,000 has possibly been misappropriated. And but go ahead, Mr. Allen. Just want to continue to highlight as we go along.
Well, Mr. Edwards, this is not the first time that this kind of action has been alleged in the Twin Cities when someone passes away. The family's from out of town. There seems like some unorganized stuff going on. And we're just going to have to get to the bottom. I don't know how we're going to do this, but we're going to have to ask people like the Urban League, the NAACP of Minneapolis branch, and others who are named in this video, give us a printout. If you had nothing to do with it, say you had nothing to do with it and walk away. But this cannot be done on a grassroots level. I think that this has to be done formally as an investigation by a legal authority to make sure that folks are subpoenaed and questioned correctly and the answers are under the color of law and you don't want to perjure yourself or anything like that. And we need to find out the real deal because, someone has wrote me a thing on Facebook, Mr. Edwards, a post that we need to quit pointing fingers and this and that is happening and all this other stuff is going on. We just need time to heal. But it seems every time there's a calm in the storm, you have some knuckleheads clandestinely and surreptitiously pulling some crap on the community. And it's not you or I, Mr. Edwards, at all. We're doing the radio thing. We're telling people what's going on.
Merely bringing the news and the information. And these are some rather disturbing aspects of what has been a very highly touted, in fact, just let's say 8 to 9 days ago before the tragedies in places like California and et cetera. I mean, this was like number three news story across the United States, only exceeded by ISIS, if you will, and the bombings and et cetera. And yet I am concerned, Mr. Allen, that there's now this kind of dispute at the very top of the Minneapolis branch of the NAACP. They can attempt to dismiss however they want, but that email that you read to us, or text message, was from the first vice president, who was constitutionally elected just as the president was, with full powers and authority, if you will. And this seems to be, unfortunately, this seems to be consistent with the statements that were made at St. Peter's AME Church on the occasion of the visit by the national president of the NAACP, Dr. Brooks, with regards to conduct or misconduct as it pertains to the branch. And I know that people wanted to rail against Mr. Nelson last week on this program, if you will. I think that Mr. Nelson did an excellent job of standing his ground, if you will, and laying out the facts, the material facts, and et cetera. But now we're talking in terms of at least $100,000 that was raised to assist organizations who allegedly were fighting for justice on behalf of Jamar Clark, if you will, that we have heard, unless somebody's going to be able to say that that was not his sister, that that was a falsification and a sham of a telephone call and communication, et cetera, which if someone is prepared to make that quantum leap, if you will, we certainly will hear it and entertain it. But we will make sure that the person is examined themselves with regards to the statements. And then the text message. You know, what did Vice President Natanya Johnson mean when she talked in terms of the executive committee of the NAACP being shut out of the process and not being made aware of decisions until after the decisions had been made? And how much volatility, because last week's program, we had a caller who, Mr. Allen and myself know who that person was, who put themselves in the position, allegedly, of having been there, though they were not upstairs at the executive committee meeting, and we raised questions. I cannot speak for my colleague on this, but I thought that Mr. Nelson did an excellent job of laying out and detailing the dynamics of what happened in that meeting first Tuesday of the month here in Minneapolis, which ultimately led to the presence of two white gunmen, which then led to an attempt to actually call the inspector of the 4th Precinct to come to the meeting at the facility on Broadway to provide security for the president and other officials of the NAACP. And I will not step away from information that I received and just returned yesterday afternoon where, and I want to repeat this again for those that say that they are close to the protected, what we call the protected services, that's the police and fire, who say that the African-American firefighters and police were not insulted, angry, disrespected, and et cetera, during the 18 days of occupation. And that will be a discussion on this program, certainly over the next, because we are going until 10 this evening. But, Mr. Allen, the phone lines are open. I'm interested to hear what folks are prepared to say in defense of the organizations that were identified by the sister of Mr. Clark as having been involved in raising money which was not properly dispensed.
Okay, Mr. Edwards, I need to tell you something. There must be a game somewhere tonight because this person who worked at
Los Angeles Lakers, this is the last appearance in Minnesota by the legendary Kobe Bryant, who is in his 20th season. Just a week ago, Kobe announced that this will be his final season. And so as the Lakers play games in other NBA cities, they only play once here in Minnesota this year, and so there's a sellout crowd at the we are watching it on monitors here in the studio. There's a sellout crowd at Target Center. So you are absolutely on point, sir. Are you still with me, Don?
Yes, I am still with you, and I just want to say that there's a legal person who works at a law firm who has contacted me via email, who likes to make the point that the money went to the adopted family who had custody of him since he was 4 years old. This is Jamar Clark.
his birth family will never see a dime because legally they have no right. And I asked her, well, was the amount around $100,000? She says, I don't know what the amount was, but it damn sure wasn't $100K.
So okay, now is this attorney said. Who is texting you, is she representing the birth, I mean, the adoptive family? And
no, no,
she
had
a chance
friend.
To examine
nope.
the books? Because, you know, we got into this issue last week when the
yeah.
caller mm-hmm. kind of misspoke and stumbled about the fact that they did not have a document, which was the financial statement of the NAACP branch. And so the question is, we're now hearing that it wasn't $100K, but yet they maintain that they have enough information about the fact that the adopted family, if you will, of the deceased, would be the recipients of the monies. And so we heard the statement by the sister, who is a biological sister and relative of the deceased, which indicates that he may not even have a headstone, even the casket may have been rented, if you will, which then raises serious questions. But that, irrespective of what this attorney has said, that accounts were open. And we both know that is factual because we were hearing discussions and reflections about the many accounts that were opened in the name of the deceased, if you will. And so can a person operating as a person with knowledge legally as an attorney at law, can they identify how many accounts were open?
No, she is just a friend of the family, and she wanted me to make it pretty clear. She can't call in, but she saw the post via Facebook,
mm-hmm.
and she's at the game, but she says she does not represent them. She just knows them and knows who the family, the adopted family, and she says they ordered a headstone. So,
there is confirmation by the biological sister in the intercepted telephone communication that there is currently no headstone. Well, if we keep talking, maybe our friend who, and boy, it must be amazing too. They must have to go out in the hall because that crowd is absolutely rambunctious down there tonight at the Target Center. But we appreciate any additional information or reflections that the person has. We renew, though, here on the Don and Ron program. How many accounts were open in the name of the deceased or in the name of the Clark family? Because the adopted family does not have the same last name, quote unquote Clark, you know. But anyway, so in fact, I heard the two names. I heard the name Hill. I think you did.
Yep.
Also, we also heard the name of another relative named Cameron. So, but I, you know, just for the purposes of transparency and clarification, how many accounts were opened on behalf of the deceased?
Exactly. That's all we want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And all it has to do is rise to the top, and someone just has to, you know, let people know what's going on because there's some coonery in the mix right now,
mm-hmm.
and someone's not coming clean at all. By the way, our number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. Now, I've had a couple of people here on hold, Mr. Edwards, but let me see if they would like to say something here since the beginning of the show.
Absolutely.
St. Paul number, you're live on the air. Would you like to speak to the host?
Hello, is that me?
That's you, sir.
Yes, it is, sir. It's you. Go ahead.
You know, Mr. Edwards and Mr. Allen, I was going to bring up something else tonight. But as a person who's been doing programming in the Twin Cities community for 26 years, you mean to tell me that this money was raised for a concert with a Grammy Award group and this young man got buried without a tombstone?
Or a headstone, right.
Headstone.
Well, we heard the conversation that the Intercept on this program. And of course, it's being played everywhere now by every conservative and liberal blogger. We luckily had a person who allegedly is listening to our program while attending the game at Target Center between the Timberwolves, who, by the way, are in the lead by 3 points. And that person, who says they are an attorney at law and a friend of the family but not representing them legally, confirmed what the biological sister said in the telephone conversation that took place apparently this morning, that a – how was it put, Mr. Allen, that a headstone is on order. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep, exactly.
So go ahead, call
exactly.
out of St. Paul, your observation, sir.
Well, in the newspaper today, there's a picture of a news conference being given by the Black Lives Matter lady. And as you touched on a couple of weeks ago, they're building a new unemployment center. Now,
right.
with the old unemployment center still there, how are we having these press conferences without a drawn-up plan to deal with the issue that we all know has been there for over 50 years? I just can't understand what's happening here and who our leaders really are.
Well, I have to take the opportunity, sir, the caller from St. Paul, because I had given formal notice at the top of our program this evening that I have been actually asked by the leadership of both fire and police, African-American associations. They are both hurt, deeply hurt. They are embarrassed, if you will, but they are also angry with regards to the manner in which they were treated during that 18 days. It really, I think, hit an abyss in that regards when the highest-ranking African-American assistant chief of the Minneapolis Fire Department, Mr. Tyner, whose family is well-known in the city of Minneapolis and in North Minneapolis, who grew up actually about two blocks away from the Fourth Precinct, was just blessed out, I mean, cursed out, I mean, called every imaginable name by individuals. And one of the things that has created the problem now is that there are pictures. Everybody likes to talk about videos and et cetera. There are pictures of the responsible leadership of the NAACP, as an example, and Black Lives Matter, standing there actually watching the disrespect, the just outrageous comments made to the highest-ranking African-American in the police department, Deputy Chief Ed Redondo, and in the fire department, Assistant Chief Tyner, if you will. But there were other young African-American officers, and about four of them, who grew up in North Minneapolis, who were just berated. And in fact, it got to the place where actually white officers became embarrassed with the continued reference to NIGs and black SOBs and even statements made about the parents of these individuals and et cetera. And so what I had shared with my colleague that in a series of meetings, which have certainly been closed to the public by these what we call protective services, that they are going to ask the national NAACP to issue an apology based on the attacks, comments, and et cetera, made by African-Americans. And I concur with that for this reason. You know, during the time that I was outside of Minnesota for a 10-day period and was staying in contact with any number of sources, and I started hearing these statements about that one of the demands, apparently a number of demands, but one of the demands was that there be an increase in the number of African-Americans in the Minneapolis Police Department, if you will. The fire department is handled a little bit differently because there is a federal court supervision. But after I myself saw some of the outrageous comments and threats that were being made, I just don't know how the NAACP and Black Lives Matter feel that they have any leverage or bring any respect for them to the table with the African-American associations for both the fire and the police. Now, maybe, you know, there are people out there that jump up and say that, that they're, you know, a bunch of Uncle Toms and they don't deserve to be respected and et cetera. Well, okay, you know, that's great if that's your belief. But then don't be a hypocrite and talk in terms that is a part of the demands that you're making is that that includes wanting to increase the participation and the presence of African-Americans in the Minneapolis Police Department and to the fire department. And the two organizations, fire and police, have put together and will be sending apparently a correspondence, a communique, to the national NAACP asking for a formal apology. Now, I don't think that's going to be forthcoming, gentlemen, you know, given the strife and et cetera that, that is taking place. But caller out of St. Paul, I mean, do you have any reflections on the kind of outrageous disdain and hostility shown to both black firefighters and black police officers? I mean, is there something I'm missing? Is there some logical, acceptable protocol and action that can be justified?
You know, I have to say that I worked my first 10 years up here at the Juvenile Correctional Center when it was brand new. And I realized when you walk that line, mainstream black folks want to view you as a sellout. But if you wasn't there, it'd be a whole lot worse than what it is. Trust me. And even as a school teacher, I thought my first name was Fat MF, Uncle Tom.
Okay.
And what African-Americans are not being taught, especially the new generation, is that people gave their lives to get in these positions. And they did that because they wanted to make their own neighborhoods that they live in and grew up in a lot better. But when things like this happen, we want to quickly adhere to stereotypes faster than white people put stereotypes on us.
Well, that is absolutely correct, and there is video that was taken by the MPD. There's also video that was taken by some of the television stations and even the Star Tribune, in which it is quite clear in these pictures that the leadership of the NAACP and quote-unquote Black Lives Matter were actually encouraging this kind of conduct, including, I remember, the second night of the disturbances when Deputy Chief Arredondo's automobile, his windows were broken out, his tires were flattened. The Arredondo family has lived in this community for many, many, many years. There's really no one as personable and as professional as Deputy Chief Arredondo in the case of Mr. Tyner. I was present and was presiding over, quote-unquote, the fire department when young men like him were encouraged to become firefighters and et cetera. I have to tell you, gentlemen, I was just absolutely embarrassed for us, if you will. Maybe folks are so tough and et cetera that they, that, you know, don't be embarrassed for me, man, because I'm, you know, I'm out here doing my thing and et cetera, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean. But, you know, you just said something, caller, that is a phrase that I have embraced, and if it were not for the thin blue line of black police officers in many cities around the country, things would be a whole lot worse than what they are. But, you know, again, people can indicate that that don't mean nothing, that's just a bunch of BS, and ain't nothing changed, if you will. Well, I tell you what, given what I've seen on the part of some folks, black, white, or whatever else, I fear sometime if we were ever in a situation where we did not have quote-unquote law and protection. So that's my sense. Anything else, caller? We appreciate you taking the time, man.
I'd like to say thank you very much, and you can just go ahead and mute me because I don't have my computer, so the only way I can listen to you is through my cell phone.
It's on the phone.
So I just want to continue listening to the program.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Allen, go ahead, my brother.
Yeah, we have another caller. Caller, you are live on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Gentlemen, am I live on the air?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yes, you are,
sir.
How
are
you doing,
sir?
My brother? Good to hear from you.
Yes, this is Mr. M. I'm calling from my palatial estate in South Minneapolis.
All right.
Boy, I don't know where to start. I mean, you know, I really, you know, I mean, this thing has been such a whirlwind of what's going on. I mean, with Mr. Clark, with, you know, and it's so sad, you know, the man's, you know, memory being, but as Mr. Allen said, it's not uncommon that chaos and confusion can happen in these kind of situations with our families. It's a sad, sad, sad type of a deal. But also in that vein, too, I mean, something about monies and a foster provider. I mean, from what I saw, this young man was 24 years old.
Absolutely.
This was a grown man. This was a grown man. So, I mean, the laws are that there's no, I mean, foster people, and they have nothing to do with this gentleman at this point.
Oops, we finally got someone that knows the law. Go right ahead, Em. Thank you.
I mean, that's usually what they do when these, you know, young people in foster care turn 18. They, you know, throw them out to open up that slot for somebody else that can be a paid participant in the program.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't understand what that part is. That's very, very, very confusing to me, along with so many other things that I see here. I mean, you know, the University of Minnesota Athletics. You know, the big article in the paper, how big investigation shows, oh, there was no misconduct, it was just Teague. Well,
right.
he did it. He's your leader. What do you mean it's no misconduct? Oh, we're so relieved now that we saw, oh, there's nothing, oh, everything is hunky-dory here, it's just beautiful. It was just one man, blah, blah, blah. Well, he's the leader of the whole thing. So it permeates the whole. So they're just trying to wipe this right under the rug. It's just, you know, reading the paper, you know, I don't know if they think some people just can't see or can't grasp what they're saying. I mean, and then, you know, to turn to another quick thing, you know, the Minnesota Vikings. Everything is Teddy Bridgewater's fault. Well, they have an offensive coordinator that calls the plays.
Called Norm Turner, yes.
A very experienced, you know, even though he's coached teams where he's had all the talent in the world and couldn't do nothing with it. But
that's right.
Why don't they put him at the podium?
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't he come up and let them grill him about why they're not doing any? He wants to call the plays, isn't he?
That's right. He's the offensive coordinator.
He's the offensive coordinator. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then, you know, this terrorism stuff, which is so maddening and confusing, the words they use and, you know, and the United States, I mean, their history of going in and saying they're going to take people out, and they have a terrible record, okay?
By the way, just to remind our audiences internationally and domestically, that's what the drones are all about. You know, and periodically, as there's been an attempt to join some kind of discussion about, you know, these drones. By the way, we you know, I'm very much involved in research in a sec. I mean, the drone attacks basically 70% of the time kill innocent people, and they are then immediately referred to as what? Collateral damage.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And
but
go ahead, Ian.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, no.
No, I was going to interject something there, but go ahead.
Sure,
yeah.
Mr. Allen.
Go ahead, Ian. I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
Well,
I'll do it after you finish.
Well, you know, I mean, their track record, you know, they went over back in the 50s, they went over to Korea, and they thought they were going to take care of that until Chairman Mao sent his forces over there and ran them back to the 38th parallel, where they sit to this day.
Actually,
okay.
Let me just correct you just a tad. At one point, sent them all the way back to a place called Busan, at the very southern tip of South Korea, and damn near pushed them off into the sea, if you will.
And then,
Yeah.
And then the chairman told him, you're nothing but a paper tiger.
Mm-hmm.
So that you had no, they said you can come over here if you want. So all of this rhetoric and all of this, it's just, you know, I mean, watching these airwaves, it's just kind of ridiculous to me. And, you know, I mean, then this Minneapolis superintendent thing.
Oh, didn't they send a message to the black? Thank you for bringing it up.
I hope I'm not jumping around too much.
No, because this is what
perfect.
The news flow must be like. Did they not send a message to the African American community, which last time I looked, 62-63% or more of the students in the Minneapolis public school system are students of African and African American background?
Yeah.
But they sent a real message. By the way, I was just, you know, amused by the statement that we have offered him a contract, we're involved in negotiations, and now we're going to go out to Massachusetts.
Go have a visit.
Now
we're going to have
a fact-finding.
Now we're going to have the visit after we had already.
I have to say something. Here goes the deal. This is why they hired this guy. Yeah, it sends a message to the African-American community. And that's shameful that, you know, I didn't like Gore anyway. But this guy was hired for strategic reasons. He's been at the beginning, middle, and end of a state takeover of a school system. Okay?
You're talking about in Massachusetts, right.
In Massachusetts, yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And so
mm-hmm.
he knows what to expect, what's going to happen. Minneapolis Public Schools is heading that direction. They needed that resource.
Okay.
That's why they hired this man, okay? Because they know it's there's no way this new Hispanic Latino superintendent is going to fix the achievement gap. There's too many collective impact agencies getting money from the state and the feds to govern over the little Negro children, but yet we have 40 to 60 kids, 60% of children in Minneapolis St. Paul Public Schools not graduating, okay? There's some of the worst disparities. I see the classrooms every day. It's ugly. And so, with that said, the next thing that they have to do is be held in receivership. Now, I got to give the Minneapolis School Board credit. They're panicked. They're scared. And why not hire this guy who can see it coming and navigate them? Okay?
with good reason. With good reason. You pointed with good reason. You know. But, you know, the man that they had in there, you know, an interim basis, I mean, he's never been a principal. He's never taught in a classroom, okay?
Oops.
He's never been a principal, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have a doctorate.
Thank you.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
okay?
Right.
He has to go. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, let me also say about that, but yet at the same time, in his interimship, if you will, he jettisoned out of the door almost 400 employees from 1250 West Broadway, and a lot of them were individuals of color and African-Americans.
Long-time
employees, yes.
Employees, I know it.
Yeah.
I know.
400. 400 was the number that he jettisoned. And, in fact, I have in the secret files the entire roster. I have the entire roster, gentlemen, of those that were pushed out, let go. And that was, remember how touted that was, that this was to make us, I mean them, the school district, special school district number one, more leaner and meaner and more effective. That's what folks told us. They were given their pink slips.
And Mr. Edwards and M, I need to take you both with experience that you guys have from corporate America. I need to take you back to corporate America.
Mm-hmm.
This is by design, okay? Gore's placement in the Minneapolis public schools to make it leaner, to get rid of the people, that's part of that let's get this guy to do this. Let's get someone to hire someone outside that's going to deal with this firestorm that's getting ready to hit us, and let's move right along into oblivion, basically. So I'm looking at the whole picture from the time the Superintendent Bernadette Johnson split almost $217,000 between her administrators because they said they weren't getting paid on compared to the national level, to the point where most of those people that received that a lot of that $250,000 or $217,000 were some of the people that Gore got rid of.
Yes, they were.
Yeah.
And you take a look at the roster again. As I said, we have the roster in the special file. It was interesting, and him just also pointed out these were people with a long tenure of knowing the system and how the system worked in the Minneapolis Public Schools. Gone.
You know,
I always wondered how that knowledge and experience was going to be replaced.
Well,
but,
that's
not our call, I guess.
If I'm not mistaken, and I think Mr. Edwards, you could correct me if I'm wrong. But I believe that Mr. Gore at one time might have been connected with something called the, what is that thing with R.T. Ryback?
Generation Next
or something like that. A supposed think tank.
A collective impact agency.
See, Mr. Allen knows all about the proper terminology. There it is right there. Yeah.
Well, when you start hunting these rats, you get to the rat hole. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Eventually,
yes.
You get to where they come out of. See?
Yeah. Now you have to remember also that Mr. Gore, oftentimes though, followed on the coattails of the other Johnson, if you will, who was well respected and etc., but got out of here. And went to Memphis and then took Gore down there with her and then left Memphis and went out to Boston where they brought him back as a number two person in the district. And I don't think that former Superintendent Bernadette Johnson realized how much he was stabbing her in the back. Oops.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I guess in passing, I don't want to take up your show, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. This is just so riveting, this expose on the failures, actually abject failures that have gone in here in the city of Minneapolis. But I do want to ask something, your opinion about this entity that I've seen some, articles on, and matter of fact, I've seen a gentleman come on TV after the great program that I watch, Black Focus. I watch it every Sunday.
Oh, thank you, sir.
There was a gentleman that comes on after that, and I saw quite a great long soliloquy about something called the CSI.
Yes, there was an article in the Spokesman Recorder. I know while I couldn't quite understand why that was back. Yeah.
And I don't know, what is your impressions of, CSI? I guess my just initial not knowing, the gentleman whose program comes on after the great Black Focus program, I think he might be connected somehow with that. But it doesn't seem like the type, you'd want to give $300,000 to do.
Well, on the situation with CSI.
But I don't know. So I'm trying to be enlightened on it.
The CSI situation, what has been kind of lost is that the person that really was the legitimate instrument, as they like to say, was the current director of the Washington Ramsey County CAP agency and former executive director of the Minneapolis.
Who should know better?
Clarence Hightower, yes.
Who should know better?
Yeah. I'm not understanding because obviously the contract was voided, if you will, with the CSI piece. That was almost a year ago. It was a year ago. I'm not sure why that was back in play, other than to remind us that something was at play, whatever that was supposed to mean. But now that takes us into a lot of money. Man, a lot of money had been funneled into the African American community to help the least of our people, particularly our children, etc. And I still remind people of the piece written by then NAACP President Booker Hodges, in which he went back, I think it was about 15 years, over a period of 15 years, and talked in terms of the millions and millions and millions of dollars that had been brought into play. No one has ever explained that. And on this particular note, no one can even explain, doesn't want us to talk about the Black History Museum.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, $3 million just kind of just went down the drain or was left on the tables or what, in Vegas or something. I don't know. We don't seem to be very tenacious in talking about these kinds of things, but then we're confronted with the terrible, terrible tragedies that are taking place, including, as Mr. Allen and I have said, while all of the occupation was going on, black folks were still being killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's like the song Tower of Power called Tax to the Max.
Okay.
We're taxed to the max, but where has the money gone?
And that's what young Booker T. Hodges, who, you know, left, stepped down as NAACP president about 4 years ago or thereabouts. That's kind of what he said. And now here we are again with the first vice president of the NAACP saying and accusing the president of being in violation of the Constitution and bylaws. You know, M., you and I know the history of an NAACP in this town when it, you know, used to mean something.
It certainly did. Yeah. It's really sad to see what appears to be the demise. You know, but at the same point, you know, Mr. Edwards, I have to continue to have faith in our young people to really figure this out because, you know, that's just kind of the way it's going to have to be. They're going to have to start to figure this out. They're going to have to figure, you know, I was hopeful of Black Lives Matter, and I still am, I guess I'm on board with their energy, with their passion. But, I mean, it really comes down to having strategy. You know, you can't close your eyes and start swinging at a man. You know, I mean, you get knocked out that way.
Yeah, you put the words right out of my mouth, sir. That's right. You get KO'd. Not even TKO'd. You just get KO'd. You just get
you
laid
don't
out on the floor,
count.
Flat on your
don't
back, or you know,
you
get hit the right way, you fall flat on your face, and that's absolutely what it is. All right, sir. We want to thank you. Any other observations that you may have for us? Maybe any additional callers, because the lines will be open for another 30 minutes. We raised some issues. I'd like to hear from the leadership and the power brokers of the powerful NAACP.
But I just have one more thing, I guess, before I go. There was a meeting that came to my attention. I didn't go to it. I thought it was tonight, but I think it's going to be, maybe it's tomorrow. But what they're going to do is talk about what to do with the Southside Urban League building. And somehow this lady named Glidden...
the councilwoman.
Councilwoman,
the liberal, Democrat, having, 8th Ward, right.
Having
Elizabeth,
meetings
that,
around
yeah.
here that just don't seem to make a lot of... I can't connect the dots with what she's doing, but she's supposed to be part of this, and I'm hoping to attend that meeting, I guess. I guess they just have to decide if they're going to sell the building or... But again, I believe a lot of dollars were put into building that.
Well,
and I don't know, why don't they have jobs programs?
Yes.
Why don't they have jobs programs like they used to? They used to have on-the-job training programs. They used to have things where you could walk in the door and you could walk out with a job. You could walk out with leads. You could walk out with interviews.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but I don't see any activity up there on the South Side. I don't see any cars there. I don't see anything going on.
The Urban League hasn't really been in that building for a couple of years. Also, gentlemen, I have to indicate to you, the Urban League never did really own that building. It's kind of like, you know, again, like the Urban League doesn't own all of the facility on Plymouth Avenue. See, Mr. Allen understands where I'm going with that because of the history of how, when it was all said and done, I mean, the organization was $1 million short. And if it had not been for then State Representative Gray, see, we forget quickly. A lot of people probably don't even remember Gray. But it was Gray that got his colleagues in the Minnesota legislature to come up with $1 million so that building could be completed and the African-American community would have some semblance of quote-unquote pride and et cetera. But in cutting the deal, it's actually partially owned by the Urban League and partially owned, by the city of Minneapolis. In the case of the building on 38th and 4th, never was owned by the Urban League.
Well, it's,
and they're selling their school too. Let's not forget the school on Blaisdell and 21st. I think
oh, really?
It is, right
really? I thought that was the stable. I thought they're selling that too.
No, the Minnesota Department of Ed shut that school down because, as me and Mr. Edwards have reported since 2008, they never submit their grade to the state. And so when every time you want to look and see what their proficiency rate was, there wasn't nothing, anything online. And so what, the year before last, they just said, okay, we're shutting you down. So they are selling that that property also. Those are the two buildings on the south side. And I don't think they fully own that either, Mr. Edwards. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
At one point did, and then had to do some financing maybe almost a decade ago. And partial loss control of that facility also.
Boy, a dismal picture just gets, you know, it's almost like the old Amos and Andy movie where Kingfish sold Andy a house, and it was just the front of a house. He went in the house, and he said, why am I all of a sudden in the backyard? I said, where is
it? I think I remember seeing that about 50 years ago.
It's to that level, mismanagement. And, you know, the way property is now and obtaining property, you know, the prices and things they put people through to get their hands on something like that is very difficult these days. You know, they've really made that. You can't go in and just do a handshake deal and buy a piece of property now. You can't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm. No, you're absolutely correct.
But anyway, gentlemen, you know, keep up the good work, and I'll be hopefully contributing and listening and hoping the best for our community.
All right. Thank you, Em. All right.
Okay, Mr. Allen,
line is open. I would expect some calls to probably correct us or get our minds right about the whole NAACP thing. My colleague, Mr. Allen, has reported early on in this program that a series of questions have been asked of the national leadership in Baltimore, Maryland, through the office of the director of branches, the Reverend Gail Ford, trying to get clarification on allegations that Constitution and bylaws are being violated. We are aware that complaints have been filed, and one of the complaints against the branch was filed by a gentleman who was on this program last week, a Mr. Nelson, if you will. We understand also the state conference president, who is also the president of the Rochester NAACP, has written a critical analysis of the state of the Minneapolis branch of the NAACP, if you will, and you know, we just kind of hope that things can get straight. But at the other hand, as we said earlier on this program, we stand by that statement, by the way, that the two black associations of the fire and police in the city of Minneapolis are asking for a formal apology. Two African-American firefighters and African-American police officers after 18 days of occupation. And the kinds of statements and allegations, disrespect, racial disrespect, and et cetera. And, you know, we are concerned, Mr. Allen, that somebody said something about healing. I'm just wondering, because I asked the question upon my return yesterday here to Minnesota, had anybody asked the leadership of both the police specifically and now the fire department if there could be some kind of sit down and et cetera. And I was told a couple of hours ago by the ranking leadership of the African-American, both fire and police associations, which are two separate entities, that no one has approached them about that 18 days, if you will. And I think that's so sad, particularly when so many of the African-American officers and firefighters who were being disrespected were born and raised in Minneapolis. You know what I'm saying, Don? I mean, wow.
They sure were. And Mr. Edwards, we have Mr. Jamar Nelson on the line live with us right now, actually.
Oh, Mr. Nelson. All right, well, welcome him, Don, and let's find out. I want to kind of vet Mr. Nelson. I understand that he has filed a formal complaint. Mr. Nelson, can you share with us what the status is now and what's happening?
Well, as of right now, I haven't heard back, but I've made a formal complaint. I don't know what will come of it, if anything. But again, I filed it because of the mistreatment that I endured last weekend and the lack of leadership, the serious breach of bylaws and protocols that the president has continuously disrespected. The actions that they've taken, going on national television shows, saying that they represent us, putting out their bogus information that is untrue, unfounded, and not calling any votes to that matter. The simple fact that walking out of executive meetings and doing things without even the executive committee knowing. Those are serious breaches that should be addressed, and I hope that that my filing brings attention to it, so that, listen, this isn't done out of spite. It's done out of seriousness. The fact that Madam President has gone on to disrespect Representative Ellison, call him a sellout, and dares anyone to talk about black-on-black crime in our community, calls people like myself and you gentlemen cop-outs when we need to talk about real issues at the forefront of our community. They're called sellout. She, in fact, last week there was a Twitter from a black magazine out of Baltimore that wanted me to, that started following me and started following both her, and she, by not knowing who I was, and some of her Twitter followers are mine as well. He wanted myself or her to call the show to explain what was going on in, you know, in the happenings of the Jamar Clark case. Mm-hmm. Well, she then said that she would call. I told him that I would call too. She blocked me from her Twitter followers, so I couldn't figure out what she would say. So what I did do was go onto their website, told them I would call, but somehow I wasn't able to get through. I imagine she was then calling legally to continue to spew all of the crap that she did in the meetings. It's just alarming, guys, what Ms. Pounds is doing, and there's no accountability. She's just running roughshod, and it's terrible because her predecessors, they wanted to hold him to a much higher standard. And now
that was Reverend Jerry McAfee you're talking about.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Who has continued to be a champion for the people, who has continued to talk about black-on-black crimes. But again, she's calling those gentlemen like that the old guard and said that they're not a part of the solution, that they are the problem. That, to me, is egregious and has no place in a leader's ability to lead.
Let me, because we want to share with our audience, again, both domestically and internationally, what protocol did you use, Mr. Nelson, that you feel at liberty to share with us in filing your complaint? I mean, you filed it with the national or with the state conference? What is the procedure?
Well, I filed it with the state conference, who then said that they would forward it over with my permission to the national branch, and that I would be getting in, they would be in contact with me to discuss the issues. So again,
can I say something?
Go ahead, Don. Yes, sir.
Yeah, go ahead, Mr.
Good
Allen.
Luck.
Good luck.
It's your show. Exactly.
Good luck if they get in touch with me. I real laugh, but that would have been rude. if they get in touch with you, I'm going to crack up. But I know what you're going through, and I understand it well. And, you know, I sent some information out today, actually our show, to try to get an answer from them because, like I told earlier in the show, that I forwarded the email out to Gil Ford. I just needed some closure and some determination under the color of bylaws of the national NAACP on branch and units, where I, for rhetorical questions, I have all the branch information right in front of me, and they're clearly not authorized to do a lot of the stuff they're doing.
No.
So
no. And again, the mere fact that the president won't even call a meeting where we could vote. I mean, these are little simple bylaws that, you know, she has to adhere to. And, I mean, to continue to go publicly and say that she will blatantly disregard any of the mayor's wishes, of the state representative, or anyone else. She said that she would continue to disregard any demands that they lay out. She said because they are the problem. So I think what people have to realize, too, is that she's making it harder because she doesn't believe in bridge building. And to me, that's serious. If you are a leader, you have to quit disrespecting our elected leaders in our community, because what you then do, you offend and you disrespect their constituents. There are a lot of constituents that got these people elected, white and black, and to continue to call them out, to disrespect them, how does she expect for us to achieve anything? And you're the president. So she represents us, you understand? And I don't want to be represented like that. That's not how I want a president acting. You know, there should be a protocol. There should be very least some type of vote. You know, instead of what they do is she is very good with emailing you what they intend to do. They don't ask what they should do. I will be happy to show anybody all of the emails that I received. They are not asking what we should do or any ideals. The emails that they receive are telling you what she is going to do next.
But let me ask this question, Mr. Nelson, as one who is familiar with the NAACP and its procedures and protocols and et cetera. There was an issue that was raised at the meeting at St. Peter's AME Church in South Minneapolis there at 41st and 4th. With Dr. Brooks in attendance with a cadre of some of the most powerful ecumenical leaders in the black community. And I have to ask this question because it came up last week, as you remember, when we were told that that the branch only gives financial reports out every other second, third, fourth, fifth month or whatever, which is not consistent with the bylaws of the NAACP, which calls for, you know, anytime you set up a committee, that committee is then obligated to make a monthly report. I'm being told by reliable sources that a misrepresentation was made first to the state conference, to President Brooks himself, and then officially to the national office, that the Minneapolis branch had sufficient both bonding and insurance. And the reason, gentlemen, I raise this question, because there has been discussion now within city government, some of the same council people that are running around talking about how they supported the protesters, that there's the possibility, and this is apparently on the advice of the city attorney, Susan Siegel, Mr. Allen, Mr. Nelson, that there could be enough prima facie evidence to sue the NAACP and Black Lives Matter, because we all know Black Lives Matter do not have a nonprofit number and do not have any assets. The NAACP
does. Yep.
That a legal action requiring or suing the NAACP to incur some of the costs, which is now in excess, as I understand it, in excess of $1 million, including everything from damage to the building, cleanup, overtime for police officers, and et cetera.
Yep.
I don't want to put either you or my associate, Mr. Allen, on the spot, but you are card-carrying members in good standing. What is the possibility that the branch could, in fact, be forcibly closed down if it is determined that they did not have appropriate insurance and bonding when they went into this occupation and conflict? I'll ask you this question, Mr. Nelson, because you were at the meeting and et cetera. I mean, is there any preliminary discussion going on? Does anybody even know?
Absolutely not. Last week, as you know, I tried to go and explain, and then there was another caller that tried to rebuke everything. I said, no, sir. That wasn't even brought up. And you raised a great point, because that was what me and a couple of people that were on the executive committee were talking about, that we're afraid of, that if we are sued, that this would decimate and just simply close down the chapter here in Minneapolis. But what's odd is that Madam President is a lawyer. So you would think not only should she know about due process that she doesn't believe in, but she would also know or be even seeking some type of legal advice about what could happen if, in fact, we were sued. That isn't brought up. But then again, gentlemen, this is the same lady that was standing before us last week, a lawyer, civil rights lawyer, that said about her arrest that she was didn't know what would happen to her during their arrest. Now, she said her case ended up being played out, no same or similar, and then the case would be dismissed. But she had no idea what would happen to her in her case. So I found that odd that a lawyer was saying
on that, Mr. Nelson, and my colleague, Mr. Allen, because we've talked about it in our production meetings and et cetera. People are under the impression that all 18 individuals who had been charged with trespassing at MOA were relieved of that responsibility. Actually, all reports, including court records, show that 7, including her, were quote-unquote let off. But there are 11 other people who are still facing trespassing charges.
Right,
and
right.
So I was trying to get a feel on who's going to be representing those individuals, those 11 who yet not Judge Cahill has not yet made a determination after his, 326-page opinion. That's quite an opinion, by the way. How is that going to happen? Let me also say this, gentlemen, for those that are saying, what are these cats talking about suing? You can't nobody sue them. Now, a number of years ago, the NAACP was almost bankrupt when they got themselves caught in a situation of what was called a boycott. And it was a situation where, unfortunately, they didn't use the right language. In fact, the terminology, because the Urban League under my leadership was involved in a hell of a battle with General Mills. One of the things we learned early on from our attorneys is that never use the word boycott. Use the word selective buying campaign. Am I correct, gentlemen?
Right. Yes,
and
you are.
The NAACP was sued and almost lost everything. If it had not been for the intervention of the Congressional Black Caucus, some good attorneys, including at that time the late Johnny Cochran and others with their legal expertise, the NAACP almost went under. That is the genesis, gentlemen and listening audience, for this commentator to raise the question, why was there a misrepresentation even to the national president, Dr. Brooks, that this branch did have both bonding and insurance policies to cover any kind of litigation, and now the word out of Baltimore is that, and definitely from our friend WC down there in Rochester, that there was a misrepresentation, and I guess I'm being kind of kind in using that terminology. Mr. Nelson, I have to ask you, how serious do you think the possibility of a legal action against the NAACP as an outgrowth of the occupation?
I think a very strong one, especially the fact of the language that she keeps using when interviewed, and like she just did in this NPR interview that I was reading today, when she keeps poking in the eyes of the mayor and the police chief and others. But again, I find it odd that this is an attorney doing this. You know, does she truly care about the NAACP? You know, I think she in total represents a more Black Lives Matter than she does NAACP. Mm. And I think that if she doesn't care enough, then she needs to step aside, because it is very, very serious that we would be sued for that. Because the building was graffiti, there was a Molotov cocktail thrown, all right? All of that police overtime that had incurred, that is serious. And they could then turn around and ask for those monies back. And who would be left with the bag would be the NAACP, and Madam President doesn't seem to care about it. Or she doesn't even talk about it.
All right. All right, Ms. Nelson, anything else before we let you go? We appreciate you taking the time and also confirming that you have filed a formal complaint with the state conference, which, according to what you have said, has been forwarded on to the national. Mr. Allen doesn't think very highly of that. I'm in the same boat. It'll be interesting, but it may change, Mr. Allen. Let me say this. because of the fact that President Brooks was here in Minnesota and he had a chance to be on the ground, as they like to say, boots on the ground, and I'm aware that he was significantly impacted by that meeting, and I repeat it for about the seventh time for purpose, if you will, that meeting at St. Peter's AME Church with a very powerful group, irrespective of what people think about him, you know, old guard, don't know what's happening, bunch of senile Negroes, all the kinds of outrageous statements that I've heard made. Of course, at least they haven't talked about them or disrespected them as they did black firefighters and police officers here in the city of Minneapolis. But I just hope that, and I've seen, you know, I've said this oftentimes, I just hope that they got a plan.
You know, there's no plan, and that's obvious. She goes, she's flying by the seat of her pants, and that's ridiculous. And that's why I hope that someone has to rein in Madam President. And I don't know who it is, but I hope she pokes the wrong person in the eye. And I don't mean this in a facetious way, but I think she needs to bring it down a notch, you know. Again, disrespecting our older black leadership gets us nowhere. You cannot talk about that Black Lives Matter when you want to alienate the ones that you don't like. You know, let's get real here. And so if someone doesn't rein Madam President in, we're going to be organization on the verge of bankruptcy.
All right. Thank you, Brother Nelson, and we hope to hear from you at any time with any kind of updates in what has become a rather interesting and discombobulated once proud organization. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate it, guys.
All right. Mr. Allen, I just want to take a minute, if I could, to continue to sound a warning that I hope that the leadership of the community, African-American community, decides to reach out to the protective services, fire and police, before it's too late, because I was very serious in my statement that if it were not for the thin blue line of black officers, things could have been or could be or could become much more turbulent and much more dangerous than any of us would feel comfortable with it. I mean, it has to do nothing with any threats or et cetera. But I know this, Don, black officers and black firefighters are deeply hurt by the way that they were disrespected, and they watched leadership of the two Pacific organizations stand by and encourage that kind of disrespect and that kind of humiliation.
Not good at all. Not good at all.
We've tonight played a couple of, we played an interesting tape. A member of the Clark family raising serious allegations about the possibility as much as $100,000 that cannot be accounted for, raised in the name of their biological relative. As well as apparently a serious flare-up between the first vice president of the NAACP and the president of the NAACP over issues pertaining to the constitution of the organization. Mr. Allen, anything you got? If not, man, hey, let James Brown take us on home.
Real quick here, Mr. Ellis, I just want to let you know that the there's some alleged violations within the Ramsey County Juvenile Detention Center. Seems to be some gambling going on with the supervisor, Bill Merritt, and Superintendent Brian Portson. And you could see the documents and the actual emails now posted on ourblacknews.com if you are interested in seeing that. And it's there in black and white. And we'll be back next week.
Gambling in the juvenile center. Take us home.
Bad girl.